You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity. Welcome to the Beep Dive. Today we are getting into something really fundamental, a physiological concept that honestly dictates life or death for our patients. The anaerobic threshold, or AT.
That's right.
And, you know, for us as anesthesiologists, this isn't just some abstract biology thing. It's, well, it's the critical line, isn't it? That non-negotiable line in the sand separating, let's say, compensated stability from just catastrophic cellular failure.
It really is the ultimate tipping point. You look at our source material, the core physiology texts, those landmark clinical trials, critical care guidelines.
Yeah.
They all really emphasize that managing a patient fundamentally means managing their oxygen economy.
Their oxygen budget, almost.
Exactly. Yeah. And when a patient crosses that AT line, they're not just, you know, sick or maybe a bit hypotensive. They are metabolically bankrupt. Utterly.
Wow, bankrupt. That's a strong word.
It is, but it fits.
Yeah.
And that bankruptcy, it demands immediate, really precise action from us.
So our mission for this deep dive, then, is to really pull apart the mechanisms, look at the monitoring strategies, and figure out those nuanced management steps. How do we keep patients squarely above that line?
Keep them solvent.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to map out this whole oxygen balance thing, try and spot the danger zones, and really understand why certain monitoring tools, like, say, SVRO or those dynamic indicators, why they matter so much more than just looking at static numbers.
And we absolutely have to grasp the stakes here. I mean, when oxygen supply just can't meet the demand, well, the consequences are severe. You get lactate buildup, acidosis, cellular dysfunction.
Spirals pretty quickly.
Very quickly. It progresses rapidly to increased morbidity, mortality, and often irreversible organ failure. You know, the kidney, the heart, the brain, there's all immediately vulnerable. If we can really get a handle on the AT, we've mastered a huge part of safe perioperative care.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Maybe starting with the basic physics of oxygen balance. Get our terms straight first. Right, so to help visualize this, one of the sources uses this analogy. I quite liked the bustling city power grid. Think of oxygen as the electricity powering everything in the city.
Okay.
And we've got two main players. First, there's DO, oxygen delivery. That's the power supply network itself, right? The capacity, the amount of electricity flowing into the city.
Got it, the supply side.
And that has to be balanced against the demand side, which is VO, euro, oxygen consumption.
Yeah.
This is the city's metabolic demand, how much electricity every factory, every hospital, every home is actually using.
It's that constant, often quite ravenous demand.
Yeah.
And if that demand outstrips the supply,
right?
Well, the lights flicker first, right?
Yeah.
And then eventually the whole city just shuts down.
So how is that total capacity, the DO euro, actually determined? What makes up that supply?
Well, it's essentially a product of two critical things. First, you've got cardiac output, C euro. Think of that as the flow rate, how strong the power lines are, maybe how fast the current is moving. And that's multiplied by the arterial oxygen content, CAO. Mm-hmm. Now, CAO is basically the concentration of oxygen carriers in the blood. So primarily, that's your hemoglobin level.
Right. So DO is like the strength of the flow times how much oxygen each bit of blood is actually carrying, like the number of workers carrying fuel.
Precisely. Strength of the lines times the number of fuel trucks, you could say.
So if the whole system's running smoothly, we're not actually using up all the oxygen that gets delivered, are we? Which brings us to efficiency, right? The oxygen extraction ratio. What's normal there and what happens when things get stressed?
Yeah, normally we operate with a huge reserve capacity. The tissues are, you know, pretty relaxed about it. They only extract maybe 25 to 30% of the oxygen that's delivered.
Okay.
You see this represented as that that blue line in a lot of the teaching diagrams. But when DORO, the supply, starts to fall, maybe because of bleeding or the heart's not pumping well, the tissues, they have to compensate.
They start demanding more from what little is arriving.
Exactly. The OER starts to climb quite rapidly sometimes. The tissues compensate by, as you put it earlier, squeezing the last drops of oxygen out of the blood flowing past.
So that OER might go up to, what, 50%?
Yeah.
Or even higher?
Oh, absolutely. It can climb up towards 50%, sometimes even higher, in a really desperate attempt to keep that VOR, the actual consumption, stable.
Yeah.
And this compensation, it's happening silently. It's like an internal alarm bell that we might not immediately see.
And this phase, this compensation, it works for a while, but eventually it just hits a wall. And that wall, that's the tipping point, isn't it? That's the anaerobic threshold itself.
That's the point of complete exhaustion for the aerobic system. The OUR hits its absolute physical limit. The tissues simply cannot extract any more oxygen, no matter how hard they try. And at that defining moment, the VOERO, the patient's actual metabolic rate, their oxygen usage just plateaus.
It can't go any higher using oxygen.
Correct. It can't be sustained by the aerobic system any longer, and the body's forcibly, almost violently, switched over to anaerobic metabolism.
You know, the Teating diagrams, the VOGO curve, they show this pretty well. But one of the sources brought up a really interesting nuance, something often skipped in basic classes. It's about why that VOURO doesn't usually start right at zero on the graph, at 0, 0, 0. Can we dig into that? Why is that important physiologically?
Oh, that's a fantastic point. And it is crucial because it just reinforces the reality of, well, being alive. While the curves clearly shows that VOERO becomes dependent on delivery once you drop below the AT, VO never actually hits absolute zero until biological death occurs.
Right.
Even when delivery is critically low, there's still some baseline consumption happening. Now, part of this is maintained by, you know, tiny immediate oxygen stores within the tissues themselves, but also, and this is the paradox, it's partly maintained by the very beginnings of anaerobic metabolism kicking in even before the full switch.
Okay. So having that line start a little bit up on the y-axis, it kind of emphasizes that you're always burning some oxygen just to keep the cells going, even if the flow, the DOERO, is barely a trickle.
It's exactly right. It's a reminder that metabolic demand is never truly zero in a living system. And that moment when the delivery line crosses the threshold and the VO curve flattens out that red dot you see on the graphs, that's the key clinical pearl. That's the AT. It's the precise moment tissues start, essentially borrowing against the future.
Borrowing oxygen they can't pay back immediately.
We call it oxygen debt. And like any debt, if you don't pay it back quickly, the interest, which in this case is morbidity and mortality, is absolutely brutal.
Okay, so the system flips. It goes to those dirty backup generators, anaerobic metabolism. The cost to the patient sounds immediate and pretty severe. Let's trace that biochemical fallout, starting with the energy crisis. Why is that anaerobic backup just so inefficient?
It's just a devastating drop in energy production. Think about it. Aerobic metabolism, specifically that oxidative phosphorylation pathway in the mitochondria, it turns out roughly 32 ATP molecules for every single molecule of glucose.
Okay, huge yield.
Massive. Now, anaerobic glycolysis, the backup plan, it only nets you 2 ATP. 2. You go from this incredibly efficient clean energy factory to something that's just sputtering, starved for energy, and failing.
And this energy drought, this lack of ATP, it immediately causes cellular functions to collapse, right? Specifically, you mentioned the NAUCA pump failing.
Yes, and that's probably the most visible sign, biochemically speaking, of this cellular bankruptcy. That sodium-potassium pump, it's an energy hog. It needs a huge amount of ATP just to maintain the normal electrochemical gradient across the cell membrane.
Keeping sodium out and potassium in.
Exactly. So when the ATP supply just dries up, the pump fails. Sodium floods into the cell and water follows it uncontrollably, driven by osmosis.
So the cell literally starts to swell up, filling with water. Cellular edema happens just because it can't afford the energy bill to pump the sodium out.
That's precisely it. And while the cell is swelling, these toxic byproducts are building up. Anaerobic metabolism, its main waste product is lactate.
Lactic acid.
Right. And normally the liver could clear some lactate. But without enough oxygen to process it efficiently and with ongoing production, the liver just gets overwhelmed, can't clear it fast enough. So this accumulating lactate rapidly drives down the body's pH,
leading to severe metabolic acidosis.
Correct. And that acidosis, combined with the energy crisis itself, starts causing longer-term damage. Particularly, we see mitochondrial dysfunction. It's not just a temporary power outage. The actual engine starts seizing up.
How does that happen?
Well, the low pH environment and the generation of oxygen radicals during this stress actually damage the mitochondria themselves. So even if we manage to restore oxygen delivery later on, the cell's power plants are so damaged they can't efficiently restart aerobic metabolism.
So recovery is impaired even after we fix the initial problem.
Profoundly impaired. It leads to things like organ stunning, persistent dysfunction even after the surgery or the critical illness episode seems resolved.
Okay, this really drives home why the AT is so central for us in anesthesia. It's not just about preventing hypoxia in the moment. It translates directly to postoperative complications, doesn't it? Like impaired wound healing, maybe coagulopathies.
Absolutely. And failure of those organs that are really high energy consumers, the ones we mentioned earlier, the kidney, the heart, the brain, they suffer first and hardest.
So managing AT really guides almost everything we do intraoperatively.
It has to. If your patient becomes hypotensive, the immediate question isn't just how low the pressure is, but are they crossing their AT? Because the answer dictates your next move. Is it a fluid bolus? Do they need a pressor? Or maybe an inotrope?
You have to link the intervention back to the physiology.
Every single time. The goal is always maintaining that DO a greater than VOR balance.
Okay, let's connect this physiology to some high-stakes situations we see almost daily. Where is this AT most acutely threatened in the OR?
Well, you could think of it in maybe three classic buckets or scenarios. First, and maybe most obviously, is massive hemorrhage.
Losing volume, losing blood.
Exactly. You're losing volume, yes, but critically, you're losing hemoglobin. You've lost the oxygen carriers, the workers, so your CO is just pummets, dragging DO droves down with it. Think major trauma, big vascular cases, obstetric hemorrhage.
Makes sense. What's the second bucket?
High-risk cardiac patients. So someone coming in with severe aortic stenosis, or maybe they're already in cardiogenic shock. Here, the problem is the pump itself. The cardiac output is just inadequate. The power plant simply cannot generate enough flow, enough DO rows.
Right. The heart can't keep up.
Precisely. And the third one, which you mentioned earlier, can be perhaps the most insidious, is sepsis. Because here, the challenge isn't always low cardiac output. In fact, sometimes CO can be high in early sepsis. The problem is often utilization.
The cells can't use the oxygen even if it's delivered.
Exactly. It's a utilization defect.
Yeah.
That whole sepsis cascade triggers profound mitochondrial dysfunction. The cells are literally poisoned by inflammatory mediators, maybe nitric oxide. They just cannot use the oxygen efficiently. The factories are damaged.
And there's another problem in sepsis too, right? Shunting.
Yes, absolutely. Sepsis also leads to capillary shunting. Blood essentially bypasses the capillary beds in the tissues that need the oxygen the most. It goes through these sort of microvascular thoroughfares instead.
So it's like having a full power grid. The DO might even be high, but the power lines are skipping right over the neighborhoods that are desperately calling for electricity.
That's a perfect analogy for it. It makes sepsis incredibly complex to manage from an oxygenation perspective.
Okay, before we dive into all the complex monitoring gadgets, you mentioned earlier there's that one simple, often overlooked warning sign, the one that should immediately make us think about low output and crossing the AT, even when ventilation seems stable.
Ah, yes. This is such a crucial clinical pearl from the sources. A sudden, unexpected fall in end-tidal co-uro, ET-co, during stable ventilation. That should instantly raise alarm bells about low cardiac output and potentially impending AT crossing.
That is such a huge flag in the OR, isn't it? Can you just walk us through the mechanism again? Why does low CO cause ET co-uros to drop?
Sure. So ET co-uros fundamentally reflects the carbon dioxide that's produced by metabolism, returned to the lungs via the venous blood, and then exhaled. Co-uros is the main byproduct of aerobic cellular metabolism.
Okay.
Now, if we assume co-uros production by the tissues is relatively stable, which it usually is over short periods, if metabolism hasn't drastically changed, then a sudden drop in the exhaled co-uros must mean less co-uros actually reaching the lungs from the tissues.
Because the blood flow carrying it back has slowed down.
Exactly. If cardiac output drops dramatically, the venous blood flow carrying that co-uro back to the pulmonary circulation slows right down, or in extreme cases, virtually stops. Less co-uro arrives at the lungs, less gets exhaled, and your ET co-uro reading plummets.
So the capnograph, in that sense, acts almost like a real-time, albeit indirect, indicator of systemic blood flow of cardiac output.
It really does. And critically, if the flow falters badly, that ET co-uro meter can give you a warning potentially minutes before a non-invasive blood pressure cuff cycles and reflects the drop in central perfusion, or certainly long before a lactate result comes back.
It's much faster than waiting for that lactate number, which, as you said, just confirms a crisis that already happened maybe 30, 60 minutes ago.
Precisely. ET co-uro tells you the crisis might be happening right now. It demands immediate investigation.
That kind of immediate feedback is just invaluable. Which leads us nicely into section 3. Figuring out which patients are those fragile power grids and how we set up our surveillance, our monitoring layers. We need to be proactive here.
Absolutely. We can't wait for the crash. The sources really lay out a solid framework for identifying those patients who are at high risk. These are the systems that just don't have much reserve. They can't tolerate a significant drop in DO.
Okay, so who's on that list? It starts with cardiac dysfunction, right? That seems like the most obvious failure point leading to poor DOs.
Definitely. Poor pump function is foundational.
Yeah.
Then you have patients with significant pulmonary disease. Here, the problem is often impaired gas exchange. You might have shunt physiology, where blood passes through the lungs without getting properly oxygenated.
So even before circulation becomes an issue, their CaO, or the oxygen content, is already low starting out.
Exactly. Then we absolutely have to consider patients with anemia or those at high risk for hemorrhage. A low hemoglobin count is a direct hit to CRO, doesn't matter how well the heart is pumping.
The fuel trucks are half empty.
Precisely. And, as we discussed, sepsis demands its own category because of that double whammy, the utilization problem and the shunting problem.
Right. And finally, the sources mentioned obesity. Why is obesity a specific risk factor here?
Well, obesity brings increased complexity on several fronts. First, these patients often have a significantly increased baseline VOROs just due to their larger tissue mass. They need a higher resting DORO just to stay even.
Okay, higher baseline demand.
Yes. And second, they frequently suffer from impaired ventilation perfusion, VQ matching, often due to restrictive lung mechanics from the weight in their chest wall and abdomen. So oxygen uptake can be less efficient too. These systems are often running much closer to their physiological limits even before surgery starts.
So we've identified these high-risk folks. Now, how do we monitor them? You mentioned a tiered strategy, like layered surveillance. No single number tells the whole story, right?
Exactly. We need layers.
Yeah.
Because each measurement gives us a different piece of the puzzle, and often at different times.
Okay, let's start with tier one, the invasive or global indicators. These are the big guns, the numbers that really confirm whether we've actually crossed the AT or are dangerously close.
Right. The first one, and the most familiar probably, is the arterial blood gas, ABG. Specifically, we're looking at lactate levels and the base deficit.
Okay. A rising lactate means anaerobic metabolism has definitely kicked in.
Yes. But here's the huge critical limitation we touched on earlier. Lactate takes time to accumulate and time for the lab to process the sample. Lactate clearance also takes time once you fix the problem.
So you're saying lactate is really a lagging indicator. It confirms a crisis that might have started 30, maybe 60 minutes ago. It's not giving you real-time feedback.
Precisely. It's historical data, in a sense. Useful, vital even, but not immediate. For more current feedback on the global oxygen balance, venous oxygen saturation is much more powerful. The gold standard here is mixed venous O saturation, SVO.
Which you typically measure from a pulmonary artery catheter, a PAC.
Correct. SVO Euro measures the oxygen saturation of the blood returning to the right heart after it's passed through all the body's tissues. It tells us, essentially, how much oxygen the tissues collectively extracted.
So if it dips too low, say below 60 or 65%, that means the tissues are extracting way too much oxygen.
Exactly. It signals that the O Euro is dangerously high, which strongly suggests that DORO is inadequate to meet the VO. The tissues are scraping the barrel.
But realistically, putting in a PAC carries significant risks, right? It's invasive. We don't do it for every case, only the really sickest patients, maybe complex cardiac or transplant cases.
It's absolutely true. It's reserved for high-risk scenarios. So clinically, much more often we rely on a surrogate, central venous O-Euro saturation, SCVO.
Measured from a standard central line, with the tip sitting in the superior vena cava near the right atrium.
Right. It's much easier to obtain.
Yeah.
However...
Yeah, I was going to push back here because the sources always highlight the debate around SCVO. We rely on it a lot, but isn't it inherently a bit flawed? Doesn't it mostly just reflect the oxygenation returning from the upper body, the head, and arms? And could it potentially miss significant hypoxia happening in the gut or the lower body, especially during shock states?
That is an excellent point, and it's a core clinical limitation you must understand when using SCVO. It's definitely better than having no venous saturation data, but you have to interpret it with caution.
How so?
Well, SCVO does tend to run higher, sometimes significantly higher, than a true mixed venous SVO reading. This is mainly because cerebral oxygen extraction is generally lower than the average extraction of the entire body, so the blood coming back from the brain is usually more saturated.
So it can look artificially good?
It can mask problems elsewhere, yes. Its real value often lies in the trend. Is it stable? Is it dropping? A significant drop in SCVOs is almost always concerning. But if you need truly definitive global data on oxygen extraction, the PPIC and SVOO remain superior.
Okay, that's a really important distinction. Let's move to tier two, the dynamic hemodynamic indicators. These I find really interesting because they don't just tell you if there's a problem. They can sometimes suggest how to fix it.
Exactly. These are metrics we usually get from advanced monitoring systems, maybe an arterial line connected to a specific monitor, or sometimes non-invasive cardiac output devices. We're primarily looking at stroke volume variation, SVV, and pulse pressure variation, PPV.
Right. So instead of relying on a static number like central venous pressure, CVP, which, let's be honest, we now know is often pretty misleading about volume status.
Very misleading, often.
SVV and PPV actually look at how the patient's hemodynamics change in response to the ventilator breath cycle.
Yes. They leverage the heart-lung interaction during positive pressure ventilation. Essentially, they're asking, are the heart and the circulation currently operating on that steep ascending part of the Frank-Starling curve? In other words, are they volume responsive?
Will giving more fluid actually increase the stroke volume and cardiac output?
Precisely. A high SVV or PPV, typically defined as being greater than about 10 to 13%, depending on the device and clinical context, is a strong indicator that the patient is likely preload responsive. That patient probably needs more volume, more input, to optimize their CO.
But these dynamic indicators, they're not a magic bullet, are they? Their clinical utility isn't universal. We can't just use them reliably on every single ventilated patient.
Crucially, no. And the sources are very clear about their limitations. For SVV and PPV to be accurate and interpretable, several conditions must be met.
Like what?
Well, first, the patient must be fully mechanically ventilated on a controlled mode. They cannot be taking spontaneous breaths, as that messes up the heart-lung interaction predictability.
Okay, no spontaneous breathing.
Second, they generally need to be ventilated with a reasonable tidal volume, usually considered to be at least 8 mkg of ideal body weight, to create enough cyclic change in preload. Low tidal volume ventilation can make the variation too small to be reliable.
Right, that's common now with lung protection strategies.
It is. And third, the patient absolutely must be in a regular sinus rhythm. Any significant arrhythmia, especially atrial fibrillation, completely invalidates the results because the beat-to-beat variability is no longer solely due to respiration. Open chest situations can also affect readings.
So if your patient is breathing spontaneously, has AFib, is on very low tidal volumes, or has their chest open, you basically have to rely on other indicators, maybe even a fluid challenge, to assess volume responsiveness.
That's exactly right. Understanding those limitations is absolutely vital for using these tools correctly.
Okay, really good clarification. Finally, let's touch on tier three, the regional or non-invasive indicators. These are more like our local checks on perfusion.
Right. Here we often use things like near-infrared spectroscopy, NIRS. This technology uses light waves to measure the oxygen saturation in the tissue directly under the sensor, usually on the forehead for cerebral saturation, RSOO, or sometimes on somatic sites like the flank or leg.
It gives a localized snapshot of microcirculatory oxygenation.
It does. But, and this is a big but, the utility of NIRS comes with some pretty serious constraints.
Go on.
Firstly, it is entirely site-specific. Your cerebral NIRS reading might look perfectly fine, suggesting adequate brain oxygenation. But meanwhile, the splanchnic circulation, the gut, could be profoundly hypoxic, and the NIRS wouldn't tell you that unless you had a probe there, which is uncommon.
So it doesn't give a global picture at all?
Not inherently. Furthermore, NIRS readings can be quite susceptible to artifacts, things like localized pressure on the sensor, skin thickness variations, underlying edema, or even surgical retraction near the probe can all throw off the reading. You're truly measuring the perfusion of only the small volume of tissue immediately under that probe.
Okay, so useful maybe as a trend in specific situations, like carotid surgery, but interpret with caution. What else is in tier three?
Well, there's the indirect indicator we already discussed at length, capnography, ETCO. Remember, that sudden unexplained drop should always make you think about a fall in CO and DO.
Right, the early warning system.
And then, of course, there's the one monitor we have on virtually every patient, pulse oximetry, SBO. It's ubiquitous, it's essential, but its limitation in this context needs to be hammered home constantly.
Which is?
A normal SBO reading, even 100%, absolutely does not rule out tissue hypoxia or impending AT crossing.
Because it only tells you the saturation of the hemoglobin that is circulating, not how much is circulating or if it's reaching the tissues.
Precisely. The hemoglobin might be 98% saturated, which sounds great. But if the cardiac output, the flow, is practically zero because of profound shock, then the oxygen delivery is still zero. The blood is fully loaded with oxygen, but it's just sitting there, stagnant. CPO tells you nothing about flow or delivery, only saturation.
Okay, so we've spotted the high-risk patient, and our layered monitoring may be a dropping SCVO, maybe rising lactate, maybe a plummeting ETCGO has flagged that the system is failing, or it's about to. Now we need the management plan. We need to actively rewire and optimize that system to keep metabolism aerobic.
And our interventions, as we said, they have to link directly back to fixing the components of DO, so that's cardiac output and arterial oxygen content, and also minimizing any unnecessary VO or oxygen demand.
Right. So where do we start? Usually it's about hemodynamics first, isn't it? Getting the flow back.
Yes. The absolute priority is maintaining adequate hemodynamics.
Mm.
Flow is critical.
And the first intervention most of us reach for is fluids, right? Give a bolus to increase preload, hopefully boost stroke volume and cardiac output via the Starling mechanism.
That's typically the first step, yes.
Yeah.
Especially if our dynamic indicators like SVV or PPV suggest the patient is preload responsive. But this is also the area where we probably face the greatest potential pitfall in modern practice,
which is
the very real danger of over-resuscitation with crystalloid fluids. While we definitely want to optimize preload, giving too much fluid, especially crystalloid, inevitably causes hemodilution.
Ah, right. You dilute the hemoglobin concentration.
Exactly. And since hemoglobin is the primary carrier of oxygen, hemodilution directly reduces the CAO, the arterial oxygen content. So you might succeed in increasing the cardiac output, the flow rate.
But you've diluted the fuel. You've replaced valuable hemoglobin with essentially salt water.
Precisely. You might achieve what looks like an adequate CO, but if your hemoglobin concentration drops from, say, 12 down to 8 GDL because of massive crystalloid infusion, your overall oxygen carrying capacity, and therefore your DO, is dramatically diminished. You could inadvertently push the patient closer to their AT even while improving their CO.
So it's a real tightrope walk.
It's a constant balancing act. The goal now is very much focused on goal-directed fluid therapy. That means giving only the amount of fluid the patient actually needs, ideally guided by those dynamic markers or other assessments of volume responsiveness, not just giving arbitrary boluses. We want to optimize volume without excessive hemodilution.
Okay, so let's say fluids aren't enough, or maybe the dynamic markers say they're not fluid responsive, or perhaps we know the underlying problem is poor heart muscle function. Then we move to inotropes.
Correct. If the pump itself is the primary issue, we need to improve contractility. Inotropes, like dobutamine, for instance, work by increasing the force of myocardial contraction. They make the power plant engines pump harder, aiming for a primary increase in stroke volume and cardiac output.
And there are nuances between different inotropes, too, right? Dobutamine isn't the same as, say, milrinone.
Absolutely. Dobutamine primarily boosts contractility, but it also tends to cause some vasodilation, which might actually lower the MAP sometimes, requiring careful titration or maybe addition of a pressor.
Whereas milrinone, which we often use in cardiac surgery contexts, provides inotropy but also significant vasodilation and, importantly, lusitropy. It helps the stiff ventricle relax better in diastole.
Right, which can be very beneficial for diastolic dysfunction. But that profound vasodilation often means you need more aggressive vasopressor support alongside it to maintain adequate perfusion pressure. The choice of inotrope really has to be tailored. What's this specific physiological defect we're trying to fix? Is it just poor contractility? Is there high afterload? Is diastolic function impaired?
Makes sense. And since flow alone isn't enough, you need enough pressure to actually push that oxygenated blood through the tiny capillaries into the tissues. We often need vasopressors.
Yes. Agents like norepinephrine are crucial here. The general clinical consensus, which is reinforced by major critical care and sepsis guidelines, is to maintain a mean arterial pressure, MAP, of at least 65 millimillar Hg.
Why 65?
That level is generally considered the minimum required to ensure adequate perfusion pressure across vital organ beds, especially the kidneys and the brain, overcoming their autoregulatory thresholds. Below that, flow to these organs can become pressure dependent and potentially inadequate.
And norepinephrine is often the first choice.
It's frequently preferred as a first-line vasopressor, particularly in septic shock, because it provides strong alpha-adrenergic vasoconstriction to raise MAP, but also has some beta-1 activity that can support contractility without causing excessive tachycardia, unlike pure alpha agonists, perhaps.
Okay, so we've addressed the pump and the pipes, APO and MAP. Now we need to focus on the oxygen itself, optimizing oxygenation. This is about targeting the CAOO and making sure the lungs are working efficiently.
Exactly. This involves really meticulous ventilation management. It's not just about putting the patient on the ventilator. It's about fine-tuning the settings. We need to titrate the FiOO, the fraction of inspired oxygen, to ensure adequate arterial oxygen saturation, but without causing oxygen toxicity from unnecessarily high levels.
Right. Avoid hyperoxia, if possible.
And critically, we need to optimize positive end expiratory pressure, or PEEP. too little PEEP, and alveoli collapse atelectasis, reducing the surface area for gas exchange and worsening VQ mismatch. Too much PEEP, however, can impede venous return to the heart, which can actually decrease cardiac output in DR Euro.
Another balancing act, like adjusting the airflow to the furnace, you said, maximize efficiency without choking off the fuel supply.
That's a good way to think about it. We also need to consider appropriate tidal volumes, usually aiming for lung protective strategies, for example, 6-8 millilol QU/QDL ideal body weight, to prevent ventilator-induced lung injury.
And if parts of the lung have collapsed those collapsed neighborhoods, we might need to actively reopen them.
Yes, particularly if atelectasis is significant and contributing to hypoxemia. We might employ recruitment maneuvers, which involve temporarily applying higher levels of pressure to reinflate those collapsed lung units, aiming to improve oxygenation and lung compliance.
Okay. And the most direct way to increase the oxygen content, the CAO, if the primary problem is a lack of carriers, that's transfusion.
Correct. If the reason the patient is flirting with their AT is primarily due to anemia, then giving red blood cells to increase the hemoglobin concentration will directly increase CIO, and assuming CAO is maintained, will increase DO. You are literally adding more oxygen carriers, more fuel trucks to the system.
But again, this comes with a huge neon sign saying caution, right? We don't transfuse just to hit a specific number anymore.
Absolutely not. The caution against unnecessary transfusion is paramount. We know transfusions carry significant risks, things like transfusion-related acute lung injury, TILI, transfusion-associated circulatory overload, TD-VOCO, potential immunomodulation, infections, allergic reactions, and of course, cost and resource utilization.
So the approach is generally restrictive?
Generally, yes. Many guidelines recommend a restrictive transfusion threshold, often targeting a hemoglobin level of around 7 to 8 GDL in most stable hospitalized patients, including critically ill ones. However, and this is crucial, that restriction is typically lifted immediately if the patient shows any clinical signs of inadequate oxygen delivery.
Meaning signs of end organ ischemia or evidence they might be crossing their AT, like rising lactate, falling SVO, ischemic ECG changes.
Exactly. If there's evidence of ongoing oxygen debt, despite a number like HbA1, then transfusion is strongly indicated to improve DROs. It becomes about physiology, not just the number.
Okay, that makes sense. Moving on from DROs, we also need to think about the other side of the equation, VORO, the demand. How can we manage that? One way is by tailoring anesthetic depth.
Yes, this is important. While we absolutely need to provide adequate anesthesia for immobility, amnesia, and analgesia, using excessive anesthetic depth is often counterproductive from an oxygen balance perspective.
Why is that?
Most of our potent inhaled anesthetics and many intravenous agents are myocardial depressants and vasodilators. So, unnecessarily deep anesthesia can directly reduce cardiac output and lower vascular tone, thereby decreasing DROs. We're essentially throttling the power plant unnecessarily.
So we should aim for the lightest adequate level of anesthesia.
Exactly. We need to guide a balanced anesthetic depth using tools like BIS monitoring where appropriate or careful assessment of clinical signs like hemodynamics, movement, autonomic responses to ensure we meet the patient's needs without causing excessive cardiorespiratory depression.
And finally, there's a key metabolic factor that often gets overlooked but is critical for oxygen dynamics, temperature and metabolism, specifically preventing hypothermia.
Yes, this is so important. The physiological reason why we must keep patients warm goes right back to oxygen delivery at the tissue level. Hypothermia causes a leftward shift of the hemoglobin-oxygen dissociation curve.
Okay, refresh my memory. What does that leftward shift actually mean for the tissues that are trying to grab oxygen from the blood?
It means that oxygen binds tighter to the hemoglobin molecule at colder temperatures. It's harder for the hemoglobin to release the oxygen it's carrying. So even if the arterial blood is fully saturated, high SpO and PaO, and the blood flow, CO, is adequate, the cold tissues struggle to actually extract the oxygen off the hemoglobin carrier.
Wow. So the fuel trucks arrive full, but the workers at the factory are too cold to unload the fuel.
That's a perfect way to picture it. The consequence is reduced tissue oxygen availability and potentially cellular hypoxia, despite seemingly adequate global DO equimeters. Normothermia is crucial for efficient oxygen unloading.
That's a really profound effect from something as simple as temperature. And beyond keeping patients warm, we also need meticulous acid base and glycemic control, right?
Absolutely. We need to actively correct significant metabolic acidosis, which, as we know, is often a consequence of crossing the AT in the first place. Severe acidosis itself impairs cellular function, including myocardial contractility, and we also need to avoid significant hyperglycemia.
Why hyperglycemia?
High blood sugar levels have been shown to impair mitochondrial efficiency and can worsen outcomes in critical illness, potentially by increasing oxidative stress. Keeping the cellular engines running smoothly requires managing the metabolic environment temperature, pH, glucose.
It really underscores how interconnected everything is. A simple intervention like turning up the bear hugger has direct implications for complex physiology, like oxygen extraction at the cellular level.
It's all part of that holistic approach to maintaining the oxygen balance.
So this whole strategy, identifying risk, monitoring dynamically, intervening purposefully to optimize DROs and manage VROs, it's not just theoretical or based on expert opinion anymore, is it? It's really backed by significant evidence. Let's synthesize what some of the landmark studies and guidelines tell us about this approach.
You're absolutely right. This goal-directed approach has solid evidence behind it. A key trial often cited is the OPTIMIZE trial, published back in 2014.
What did that show?
It looked at patients undergoing major gastrointestinal surgery. The intervention group receives goal-directed hemodynamic therapy, specifically using cardiac output monitoring to guide fluid administration and the use of a low-dose inotrope, dopexamine in that case, to achieve predefined targets.
And the outcome?
The group receiving this active optimization therapy had a significant reduction in postoperative complications compared to the standard care group. The core message was really powerful. Actively managing and optimizing DO rather than just reacting to problems leads to measurably better patient outcomes.
So being proactive pays off.
Definitely. And this concept has been further reinforced and refined by consensus groups like POQI, the Perioperative Quality Initiative.
What's their stance?
PQI has published numerous consensus statements strongly emphasizing the importance of early, aggressive, goal-directed fluid and hemodynamic optimization, particularly in patients undergoing high-risk surgery. Their frameworks explicitly state that preventing oxygen debt by using preemptive monitoring and targeted interventions is absolutely paramount to reducing perioperative morbidity and mortality.
It's about getting ahead of the curve, not chasing it.
Exactly. And you see these same principles woven deeply into modern standardized care bundles, most notably the ERS protocols, enhanced recovery after surgery.
Right. ERS is huge now in many surgical specialties. How does it relate to ATL?
Well, ERAS is essentially a collection of evidence-based practices designed to minimize the physiological stress of surgery and accelerate recovery. A huge part of that involves maintaining DO and reducing metabolic strain.
That's it.
ERAS protocols typically mandate strict adherence to normothermia, careful normovolemia, avoiding both dehydration and fluid overload, encouraging early mobilization to prevent venous stasis and improve respiratory function, and providing effective multimodal pain control to reduce the stress response and thereby lower VRO demand.
So ERAS in many ways is like a standardized protocol specifically designed to keep patients as far away from their anaerobic threshold as possible throughout the perioperative period.
That's a very accurate way to look at it. It operationalizes many of the physiological principles we've been discussing.
Okay, so if we had to distill this entire deep dive down, if we wanted to give the practitioner listening right now the single most actionable takeaway message, that final clinical synthesis, what would that be?
I'd say the AT is that critical physiological tipping point where oxygen supply fails to meet demand. Our core mission, therefore, has to be fourfold, and these need to happen almost simultaneously. First, recognize the risk. Know which patients are inherently fragile. The cardiac history, the septic patient, the anemic one, the major hemorrhage risk.
Okay, know your patient.
Second, monitor using tiers. Use that layered surveillance approach. Don't just wait for the late lagging indicators like lactate. Utilize dynamic markers like SVV or PPV where appropriate. Interpret SCVO trends cautiously and pay attention to that ETCOO.
Be proactive with monitoring.
Third, intervene with targeted purpose. Link every single intervention, every fluid bolus, every pressor adjustment, every inotrope dose, every transfusion decision directly back to fixing the underlying physiological problem in the DO equation, CO or CO3, or perhaps reducing VO demand. Don't just treat numbers, treat the physiology.
Got it. Targeted interventions.
And fourth, critically, avoid the common pitfalls. Be hypervigilant about the dangers of excessive crystalloid and hemodilution. Actively prevent and treat hypothermia because of that left shift in the O2 dissociation curve. Avoid unnecessary deep anesthesia.
Recognize risk, monitor tiered, intervene targeted, and avoid pitfalls. That's a pretty solid framework.
I think if you keep those four things in mind, you're well on your way to managing the oxygen balance effectively.
That concise checklist is perfect. It really boils down to the fact that the difference between a smooth, uneventful recovery and a major postoperative disaster often hinges on recognizing and respecting that physiological tipping point, the AT. And that actually leads me perfectly into our final provocative thought for you, the listener. Something to perhaps mull over long after the immediate crisis in the OR is resolved. We've established that crossing the AT means accumulating oxygen debt, and we know this debt causes real cellular and mitochondrial damage. Now, even if we successfully intervene, we restore DOR, we get the patient back into aerobic metabolism, we essentially pay back the principal of the debt, what might be the lingering, maybe subtle effects of that period of uncompensated borrowing.
Interesting question.
How does a severe, even if transient, oxygen debt experienced during surgery potentially affect things like long-term functional recovery, or perhaps even subtle cognitive outcomes, especially in our more vulnerable elderly patients, maybe months or even years later? It sort of challenges us to think about success not just as getting the patient out of the hospital, but ensuring their sustained quality of life afterwards.
That's an incredibly important point, and it's an area of active research. We're increasingly learning that these short-term physiological insults, these periods of oxygen debt, can indeed have long-term downstream ripple effects on organ function and overall recovery. Understanding the true cost of that debt should make us even more determined, even more aggressive in preventing it from accumulating in the first place.
Absolutely. Fascinating, complex physiology today, but the clinical imperative seems crystal clear, doesn't it? Manage the oxygen economy.
Couldn't agree more.
Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.